want those voices. But we also need the folks who lived other lives and had different experiences. And we need folks who have been there. The older teachers would hold us together when we needed to. And I think in our politics, the ability to get more of a cross-section. But look, all of us know why there's not a lot of young people in politics, because it's, you know, gerrymandered districting and money in politics that makes it impossible. The idea of a teacher with no political experience, no name recognition, and I know I repeat myself because I said I was a teacher, no money and no connections to win a congressional seat is a testament to Minnesota, to be honest, that the party is there, that you could still do it. But, and when I got there, everybody has that story. You know, everybody's Mr. Smith goes to Washington, except their parents were federal judges or something like this. You know, you're like, oh, I see. But no, I think it's that mix. And I think for me, coming in late was really good. And to be honest with you, I'm pretty agnostic about things and trying to get things done. I'll go back to that internet thing that I got on, is where I started on this, is great promise, but it created everybody's got a damn opinion about everything. Where did we lose the thing when you didn't have to have an opinion on everything? So I don't know about that. And I remember you'd go to places and you would, like, somebody be talking, and then you'd up, and then we would say, they knew this. And I kind of took politics that way. If you didn't know, you'd go to these people, they would bring you ideas, and we would work it through. Now, there's just this idea you have to have an opinion on every single thing. You have to, and you have to express it. And then I made this case backstage. I think we've got a White House that sees every single interaction as a zero sum. Somebody has to win and somebody has to lose in every single situation. And look, there's no such thing as that. There is no such thing in life. And if you want to get a good trade deal, your partners need to get a good trade deal. If you want to get legislation, you've got to compromise with the other side, and you both get a little something, and it works for everybody. That's not how they see it. They have to pound someone down. Someone has to lose in every single situation. And I think it is incredibly dangerous, and it's bringing us to a point where I don't know how you govern when it's that way, because life is not zero sum. Life is not somebody wins and somebody loses. But that's how they see it. And right now, they're winning. The billionaires are winning, and they seem okay with that.
You're listening to WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee, WMDX Columbus, Madison, WCFW HD2 W228 EP Chippewa Falls, WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, WLAK Amory, and WLCX La Crosse, a part of the Civic Media Radio Network.
You know, the weirdest thing of this whole crazy journey and all this is I couldn't have been more surprised to wake up with my head stapled to the carpet that I would be in a damn fight with the richest man in the world. Like, go do something else, for God's sakes. This guy's fighting with me online and doing these types of things. Like, when is enough for these people? When's enough money? When's enough do you have to run everything? I'll say this, and I've talked to Bernie a lot about this. I think one of the issues that we get, he's 100% right, and he's been talking about it a long time, but I think where Democrats get ourselves into a trap is when we message some of this, it looks like we're against success. We don't want somebody to succeed, or we don't want maybe, and I know maybe some people don't believe it, and fair enough on this with capitalism. Is there a moral capitalism where we can celebrate success? And I said, my beef is not with successful people. My beef is with people who get successful and then don't pay their taxes and act like terrible people and make it more difficult for the rest of us. That's the beef. So I don't think we've messaged that. I think, like, I ask people, how is Donald Trump getting some of these people to vote for him? How is he getting some of these, folks thinking that? And they said, look, Donald Trump, especially in the 80s with your people, showed this wealth. You know, it's that ostentatious show of wealth, the gaudy gold and all of that or whatever. But there's a sense of, well, I want to make it. I want to make a difference or whatever. And I think Democrats, because we do a good job of this, we want to be there, as, you know, Hubert Humphrey said, those in the shadows of life, those that are having it most difficult. We want to lift up and help our neighbors. But I think there's a whole group of people in America that feel like those programs aren't helping them and nobody's working for their success. And I think Democrats understand the Paul Wellstone thing. We all do better when we all do better. Lift everybody up and make that case.
So you were talking about having a beef with certain folks. I got a beef with you. And this is a pretty serious thing.
You're not the richest man in the world, so it's not as scary.
But, well, I don't know. It's a, you have no idea.
He does buy his ink in 50-gallon drums,
I've been
so that's
throwing
it,
my
so.
Change into a box every night when I get home, and it's getting pretty heavy. Now I got a beef with you. I'm multi-generational Wisconsinite, and I happen to believe this is the greatest state.
It is a great state.
No, the greatest state. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
And I've also always thought that this is the most progressive state. This is the state of Robert M. La Follette.
Yes.
And all these great traditions. Yeah, they should applaud for that, of
they
course.
They should.
Yeah.
This is the home of labor unions,
labor,
the home of
movement, stuff like this.
Co-ops, yeah.
So this is my beef with you, and it's pretty serious. Back in 2010, there was a Republican wave. And your predecessor, Mark Dayton,
yeah,
he won by about 10,000 votes. It was a very close election back in 2010. And so you guys stayed Democratic, and you were able to keep gerrymandering in the legislature, at least to some extent, and stuff like that. And we had Scott Walker.
Yes.
And
this is a very important point. This is a divergent point. It very much is.
And this is my beef, actually.
Yeah.
Because, I kind of want Wisconsin to be just, in the Garrison Keillor tradition, whatever, it's a little bit better than Minnesota. And it, just for the last like 15 years, you guys have been kind of pacing us on a lot of stuff. And so explain to me what the difference between Wisconsin and Minnesota is.
No, this is important. By the way, as a side note to this, Mark Dayton and those 10,000 votes, some of you might in here know this, but it'll really, you know who he beat? Tom Emmer, the number three guy in the House, who I was friends with and had gone trap shooting with and know, and I feel like he's lost. We did an impromptu like charity event in D.C. where we did impromptu theater together, and now I just got subpoenaed to go out there, and he just treats me like hell. And anyway, side note to that, look, we said this. That division, that election was the most important thing that happened, I think, in Minnesota history, and Mark Dayton's win in 2010. I squeaked by kind of with a third-party candidate. Got in. I won that election in 2010 in my congressional district by, I think I ended up with 47% of the vote because we split it.
So you didn't get the majority. You
no,
had,
no,
it was
I didn't
a tough
get the
one
majority.
For you. Mark Dayton did win by about 10,000 votes. It was very, very intense. Very
changed
close.
The entire trajectory of the state.
That's exactly right. And we, in that same election, went another direction that continues, although we have a very good Democratic governor now. But it
yeah, give Tony
yeah,
Evers
Tony
one.
Evers, so. Yeah. But we still
have. Yeah, here's, you want, I'll tell you what I, first of all, my 2018 kind of non-official campaign, it was One Minnesota was my official campaign theme, but my non-official campaign theme, and labor unions were all over this, telling people in 2018 they had to vote, it's Walls or Wisconsin, people. We're going to go right down the way of Wisconsin. Scott Walker, we're going to lose everything. We're going to come right to work. And I will
see,
say this.
That doesn't make me feel all that
no,
good.
No, but I will say this in full disclosure. All those things are true, and Minnesotans did see Wisconsin as more progressive. Minnesotans understood the history. And to be very candid, for some of you more experienced people in here will know, but for the younger folks, this might strike you as odd. Iowa was moving with us. Iowa voted for Barack Obama overwhelmingly. So, and this wasn't that long ago. Now, I say that as an optimism. If you remember after the 2004 election, it's like we were going to be in the wilderness forever. 2006, I'm in Congress. 2008, an unknown senator from Illinois is president, and there we go. And then we pass the Affordable Care Act, and we're back down. The oscillation of this. Now, I think it's going to be harder because these guys are cheating and gerrymandering and stopping mail-in voting and all that. But once it divided, what Minnesota understood after that election was a re-energizing of the party. And I will make the case on this is, we're winning elections in Minnesota, not that our demographics are that different. We are strictly a purple state. Our numbers look almost the same as Michigan, as Pennsylvania, as Wisconsin. But we continue to win because of the party organization. And it's down to the county level, it's down to the city level, and there's just such an emphasis that we've been able to pull people over on simply organizing on a broader scale. And we get high voter turnout, just like you. So the way out of this is just going to have to be massive organization. And look, it is crap. Again, I wish I could just go home and not think about the president and not be engaged. We don't have that luxury. And it's going to have to be to organize ourselves out of it. I know it sounds like a cliche, and most of it is just grind it out, get people out there. Everybody's looking for, what's the message that Democrats can make? I don't know. I thought we were making it, but I'll tell you what didn't work. 70 million people stayed home. I have very little confidence we're going to move a lot of these people. At this point in time, you still think Donald Trump's good? You're there. I mean, that's just where it is. But there's too many people that we can get to. And I think Wisconsin is figuring that out. I think you had in Ben and now in Devon, you have a state party. You proved it to the country. The organizing around the Supreme Court special election was just amazing, inspiring. So it's organizing. And man, I'm telling you, these elections matter so much. And just the divergence between Mark Dayton's two terms. When I won in 2018, that is the first time in Minnesota history that there were three Democratic terms in a row. That's the first time it ever happened, which allowed us to build on that momentum and shift us towards a much more progressive values. And isn't it weird when you do that? We rank near the top in happiness, rank near the top in, you know, places to raise kids, rank near the top in personal incomes and all that. And I'm just going to say it, if their policies work so well, Arkansas and Mississippi would not be at the bottom of where they're at because their policies don't work.
Well, you made me feel a little bit better. And I will just tell you that eventually we're gonna do what we have to do. And
side note here, Mississippi's last gubernatorial election, the Democrat lost by 3 points.
Yes.
Just so
and
we know.
He was Elvis Presley's cousin.
That helps.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
Just to be clear. So good stuff. And I think soon we'll reestablish our Midwestern dominance, and then you can stop bragging about your 10,000 lakes, and we'll get on to some serious business.
We do not count mud holes like you do in Wisconsin. So we do not. We do not.
Okay. All right. I think we better get into some serious business here. And the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, Zoran Mamdani, was asked recently who, aside from Bernie Sanders and AOC, he thought was really, you know, an accomplished person, really kind of a role model in politics, or somebody who at least showed an example of how to do politics. And he said Tim Walz. And
that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
And as I understand it, I was talking to one of his aides the other day about this, and as I understand it, they said, well, why Tim Walz? He doesn't live in Manhattan. And he said, because as governor, he got a whole bunch of stuff done.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to give you because again, as Wisconsin, I don't want this to get too out of control, but I'm going to give you a couple minutes to tell us a little bit what is referred to as the Minnesota miracle.
Yeah, and this is a key point, too, and this is another thing I would tell Democrats is when you win elections and you've got power, you don't bank that political capital to win the next election. You burn it to improve lives, because not only then did you improve lives, you show the people who worked their tails off and gave you money and door knocked on this that their lives improved almost immediately. I had a young staffer who got on our campaign and worked for us, and then in 2023, we did pass everything, paid family and medical leave, 20 weeks, most generous in the country. We did 2040, we're gonna totally decarbonize our electric grid by 2040. They told us we couldn't do it, they're right, we're gonna finish in 2035. And so we codified, first state to codify women's reproductive rights. We had the biggest investment in college education. If you make less than $80,000 a year, your family, and then on a sliding scale, it's free college at any of our universities in Minnesota. And just right down the list of things, we made sure that we strengthened labor unions as the core piece of this. You can't have anti-labor work. And And we moved all those things as quickly as possible. And there was this, and then, like, we got down to the end, we had a very racist state flag, so we changed the state flag into this new beautiful one. We got rid of some of those things. We passed recreational cannabis, you know, for adult use cannabis. We did these, all these things.
We're still working on that here.
I know. But I had a young volunteer that's like, well, that wasn't so hard. We won the election and we got all this stuff done. That's great. But I saw it on that. I'm like, there's an entire generation of us who were told, just be patient. There was no fierce sense of urgency. There was no direct connection between busting my butt for a candidate, electing them, going into a session. Hell, my life's a lot better now because of this. So what happens? We win the next election and we're there. So the good politics follows the good policy. And I think what Mondami's talking about is that also being proud on this. When I first was out there and got picked by Vice President Harris, I got put on one of the shows and they said, well, Governor, your policies are like way out. It's these liberal policies, whatever. And I said, oh my God, we feed our children and take care of our elderly and we can have health care and college. What a monster I am. And I think our mistake is don't let them frame us on this, because guess what? Our policies are super popular, our party not so much so. And I contest to this is because we don't, when we have the opportunity, we don't go big enough, we don't go bold enough, we don't pass the things, we don't stand with it. That's because I'll give you this. The Republicans and Donald Trump are sure showing us with this. So, and I said, we will win. And when we win back next time, we better have the same sense of purpose and urgency and Project 2025. And instead of crushing the rule of law and scooping people up and deporting or whatever, we're going to go crazy and give people health care, and we're going to go crazy and make sure that college is more affordable, and we're going to attack climate change, all these things. Just have some courage to go after it. And I think we're still so stuck in this. And this is what I go back to the beginning of this conversation, trying to work inside the system, trying to compromise. I will compromise on things, if it's taxations or some of that. I'm not going to compromise on fascism. I'm not going to compromise on reproductive rights. I'm not going to compromise on climate. And I think you said it, I believe this is true. Was it Bill Clinton? It's better to be right and weak than wrong and strong type of thing. I think we have to project both on this. I think we have to project that don't mistake our kindness for weakness, but be bold about passing these things. Now all of a sudden those casual 70 million are like, you know what, I'm going to go vote for these people because damn, it's really nice that I don't lose my job when my child had to get chemo and I can take them in and I'm not going broke because of this. And, you know, all of the things that make a difference. We had a whiteboard when we passed all the things you're talking about all the way through. And I remember we got about halfway through the session. We had about five or six things passed and people were like, wow, what a successful session. And it was Melissa Hortman said, what the hell are you talking about? We're doing everything. We're passing everything. And we just went right down there. We passed, you know how they turn you into the credit reporting and to ruin your credit, make it difficult to get insurance in a house because you had a medical bill that was a bunch of crap and you couldn't pay it. So in Minnesota, we said, you cannot report medical bills to the credit reporting agencies. You can't do that. Can't do it.
You wanted to be the Democratic nominee for vice president. And I'll tell you, I'd say it, and you can push back.
I'll give you the story of how I ended up getting it.
But let me take you back a sec. As there was this very difficult moment with Joe Biden standing down,
yep,
Kamala Harris stepping up. Kamala Harris was raised in Madison, by the way.
Right? Yeah, I knew that.
Not in Minnesota.
No, I knew that.
Okay, just to be clear. So Kamala Harris stepping up, and she needed to pick a vice presidential candidate. And in that, there was this sort of, it wasn't a campaign, but there was a point where the people who were interested in being vice president went on TV shows, and they showed a little bit of their skill. And you did that, and I would argue that you won a campaign for the vice presidential nomination without it actually being any kind of formal campaign, because you went out and you did these TV appearances. You spoke in much the way that you were just speaking right now. And an awful lot of people who didn't even know you started to say, I like that. And I think, so tell me about that journey. You can disagree with me on some elements of it, no. But just this sense that you went from being a Midwestern governor to being suddenly somebody a lot of people were very excited about.
Well, and it was, I would say this, and a privilege of a lifetime to be with Vice President Harris. And I remind people, just in case people, the humbleness and the work you did, just picture that you go home tonight and you're talking whatever and you wake up tomorrow. Imagine what a Sunday morning would look like with Kamala Harris as president. Just imagine, I think about that, and that's what she was, but just the humbleness of it and doing that. But look, I would say this, I think it's public service, and I don't want to, like, a false sense of humility. I really didn't think that that's what we were trying to do, to try and get that. I was chair of the Democratic Governors Association, so as I was pushing there, I was doing, you know, whatever needed to be done, and we needed to start messaging all that. It did become kind of this veep stakes thing or whatever, but when I talked to the vice president, I said, look, use me however you can. I just want to win. If that means going to Omaha and putting me there to get that one vote, which we did, by the way. And so I went there three times, and there was my people, but to try and make the case. But I do think it was, and I think this is a debatable piece about it, I was out there proudly espousing progressive things that we had done in Minnesota that improved lives. And I think there were people all across the country said, well, damn it, I want that. I want to get those types of things. I wish we could do that at the national level. And I think that was part of it. And I think the real reason I got picked was, is I told the vice president, asked about the job, and I said, I don't know about the job, but I know what the org chart looks like. It's the president, and it's the chief of staff, and it's all the people who work for the president, and then it's the vice president down here, so just so you know. But no, I think it was out there. What I said, I think that model, remember how exciting it was during that time, though, and Donald Trump was not in the news, and all these incredible governors, yeah. J.B. Pritzker, Josh Shapiro, Tony Evers is out there, Gretchen Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, great governors in Kentucky, you know, Democrats, and people were like, they're awesome. That is the model that I think we need right now, is because Donald Trump sucks up so much oxygen. He got frazzled. He wasn't in the news. The media was covering Democrats and covering a lot of Democrats doing good work. And all of a sudden, that whole thing was starting to shift on him. And I remember that's when I said, look, don't, these guys are bad, but they're just weird as hell. I have spent 60 years using public restrooms, and I have no damn idea who's next to me and what's going on with them. Because it's not my business. And to think how much they took on that. And I knew during that time period, Donald Trump did an interview. It was like a 15, 20-minute interview. 11 times he told us he was not weird. Pretty self-conscious. Pretty self-conscious. And look, I think that whole thing was the model. I'm saying this, whether it's doing podcasts, whether it's doing what, let's all just say, the joy that Gavin Newsom has brought us over the last few weeks. fabulous. And that is a serious governor running the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world, dealing with everything on that. But what Gavin understood was to get out there and fill that. Or you got Andy Beshear out there talking. Andy Beshear telling us, don't use words that people don't use in their daily lives. Talk the way they talk. And I think all of these different lanes, the more we fill them. I've been a big advocate, and I know it's not the Europeans do some things right. I think we need to acknowledge that. And right now, as Americans, we're like, damn, they do a lot of things right. The one thing they do is they have shadow parliament, or they have a shadow government that makes sure we keep them in check. And I know this is a bit controversial or whatever, but when things are going bad, and the people who do the work, which is most of us, you see what happens when you have a national strike in France. They shut the whole damn thing down until something changes. So I just have to tell you, until America can get unified, especially the working class together, those are the things we should be doing. And I think that's what was happening during that time. That's all I was trying to do. And it was a privilege of a lifetime to run with the vice. Look, you had 107 days to try and change this thing around. We didn't get there. I own that. She owns it. But I think now more than ever, there is still a path forward. Look, they know that the midterms are trouble. They wouldn't be trying to suppress the vote. They wouldn't be trying to gerrymander Texas. Hell, if your politics are so popular, you're just going to win everywhere. No, they're not. They're not going to win everywhere. The problem is going to be they make it more difficult to vote and they gerrymander the districts. So we've got to push back every step of the way on that.
So I'll give you space there, okay? I'll say you were out there in this mix of folks, and then you just used the word weird at the right time and became the vice presidential nominee of a major
terrifying.
Party.
It was terrifying. Like, some of you heard the story. They called, and I missed the call, of course, which is me.
Yes.
And then I got another call and said, pick up your damn phone. She called. And it is the most surreal thing. I'm sitting in my house. 20 minutes later, the helicopters are overhead. The people sweep in. My son is like, Dad, it's going crazy outside. And I'm a mouse, and they said, well, we're going to Philadelphia. We're going to get packed right now. I said, I'll go get my stuff. They said, no, you wouldn't. We'll pack for you. And I'm like, you're going to pack my underwear for me and stuff? So it's a little strange.
A little weird.
And it just went like that, and it hit the ground. And I went from no one knew. That morning, I'm sitting in Mankato, Governor, Minnesota. That night, getting ready to walk out on stage with the Vice President of the United States as she's announced me in front of 15,000 people in Philadelphia and then on TV. And I meet up with her, and we're standing there in the dark, like coming off curtain or whatever, and she looks at me, and she said, don't screw this up. And I'm like, okay. So I'm scared. I'm like, the whole thing was there is I had never used a teleprompter, and I had to use one in this. Like, this isn't some rinky-dink speech I'm giving, you know. This is, like, a big deal. So when I got there, we had, like, 45 minutes. I went back in the shower of the Temple University locker rooms, and they had set up a stage with a teleprompter to show me how to use it. And I'm like, does this kind of feel like we're on a high wire with no net here? And they're like, yeah, that's it. All right.
So many of the people in the audience have not run for vice president. And
Minnesota, we're the home of vice presidents. Walter Mondale, yeah, Hubert Humphrey. Yeah, that's
there
it.
It's left that's and right. It. Yeah. You know, but what was the most incredible thing, the most striking thing, we can use whatever word we want, that you took away from that experience? What was it about being the nominee of a major party for vice president, winning 75 million votes or and stuff like that? Tell me about what
I think we all need to remember this, just the deep decency of the American people. And, you know, to be giving at these rallies or to be talking to people and listening to people's stories. A young woman in Ann Arbor, which was one of the most magical nights. It was a beautiful fall day, fall evening. The trees were colored. They had lit them up. We're doing this big rally on the Ann Arbor campus. Maggie Rogers is going to sing. I have my daughter with me. And it just felt so right. It felt so good. And I'm walking down the rope line after speaking and talking. There was a young woman there with her child. He was probably about three. And she introduced him. She said he lost his dad last year, and I just wanted to bring him and do these things. And people just sharing their very personal stories and at a rally believing that there was something we could do together. And I got to see it. And I will tell you, for all the cruelness and all the people who do the bad stuff, whatever, my family got to see it in the most personal and probably the most broadcast moment ever. And as a father, I'll give you this. The greatest day of my life, the greatest moment, is when I'm coming out. I'm going to be the nominee for Vice President of the United States. And my son stands up and says, that's my dad. That's my dad. And I'm like, damn right. And this country who stood up and they came after it, and some of them, you know who they are, and you know the TV station that did it, wanted to try and mock that or whatever. I'll tell you what, millions of people said, we ride at dawn for Gus, I'll tell you that. That they were ready to go. And that basic humanity, that basic decency, and for me to see it on a very human, they were there for us as individuals and as people and sharing our stories together. And I have to tell you, leaving Chicago, I've been through enough of these, I kind of get the feel of the plug. I thought we were going to win. And I think it's for all of its kind, not arrogantly, but just like decency is going to win out here, is what it felt like. And so, and I still believe that. I still believe that. And I think we just have to do more to convince people that it matters, that, that going on that day and casting your vote matters.
So coming out of Chicago, you thought you were going to win. I will tell you probably that most people in this crowd thought you were going to win. Were you surprised when you got beat?
Yeah, I was. And I've been through these. I remember in 2016, Donald Trump won my congressional district by 17 points. And it was midnight. And in 2016, it was midnight. And my team was there, and I was up by 60 votes. And they said, Congressman, there's one county yet to count. And I said, well, if it's Jackson, we're all looking for work. And they said, it's not Jackson, it's Maurer, which is Austin, the most traditional
trade union town.
Trade union town, home of Hormel. It's the heart and soul of that, many generations of labor or whatever. And we ended up winning, but that was the first time since 1928, maybe, that Austin went for Donald Trump. In the county, Maurer went for Donald Trump, and that's when the switch happened. I won that congressional district, the 22 counties of that, in 2008 by over 30 percentage points. In 2016, I won it by a few thousand, and Donald Trump won by 17. That's the traditional, and you know the story. It's here, too. It's in those counties, but and we just have to figure that out. And the thing that breaks my heart is whether it's agriculture or whether it's labor, this is the most anti-agricultural farmer administration and anti-labor that we've seen. So maybe folks aren't voting on their economics. Maybe they're voting on something else. So,
do you ever think about running for president?
No, I have not. But what I do think we need to, and I tell people this. If anybody tells you they're running for president, especially right now, that's a bad thing. But I, like I said again, I don't think it hurts to have Pete Buttigieg on TV every night. I don't think it hurts to have Gretchen Whitmer. I don't think it hurts to have these members of Congress, these senators out there, that we just have to fill the zone and make the case and be proud of the policies that we care about and, God, get something done. I'll tell you what the American public doesn't want to have. With this administration, I don't think that this administration cares about sternly worded letters. I'm just telling you that. I don't think they care. So stand up and do some things, you know, lead on this, be there, make a difference. So.
So as you know, Governor Evers is standing down. There's an open race for governor of Wisconsin. And our residency laws are pretty flexible.
You got plenty of good ones here. We'll get them elected.
So I just want to make sure you're not open to coming over and making a run for governor of Wisconsin.
You got good ones here. We'll get them elected. But this is going to be big.
It is a big one here, and it's big a very one. Important one. You going to run for re-election in Minnesota?
We'll make a decision here this coming week. No one's ever got three terms in Minnesota. We don't have term limits. No one's gotten those terms. I will say that I'm not arrogant enough to think I'm the only person who can do this, but I'm also, it sure doesn't feel like now's the time to leave a field with what's going on, I think, everybody out there. So.
Some will take that as a newsworthy comment.
No decision yet, but
I understand. Hey, we're coming around the corner, but these people seem to like you so much. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions. Is that okay? All right.
It's not the Minnesota nice, the passive aggressive like you. I was going to say it's so great to have you all here, so engaged in your community. But then I'm wondering, it's maybe you just don't have a social life, like me. So.
You know, my mom is a good Wisconsinite. We're not so braggy, so we don't have a Wisconsin nice thing or something like that. But my mom always says, and my beloved 94-year-old mom, she always says that you know, we're always nice to their face.
Yeah.
But after they leave,
Yeah.
You know, so that's just a, so you know, you better do well here because
I would like her. I would like her though.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, you would like my mom. But so my favorite thing you did in the 2024 presidential campaign was kind of like, you know, like fix up your car. And the big thing about it was you had a 1979, I think it was 79,
yeah,
vehicle. And
international,
yeah. And I thought this could in fact be BS, right? Yeah. You know, we don't know. This guy from Minnesota, they're you can't always trust him. And all fake. So,
I apparently was a Manchurian candidate. You know that the Chinese work. Yeah.
And so there, you're fixing it up. And the thing that sold me on you was that you had a car, the band The Cars. You had a cassette.
I did.
And I think it was a cassette. Eight track, even better. And so
Columbia House, I never did pay them for it. And so some of you know. Yeah.
Revelation,
well, for a penny.
Statute of limitations. But you had the Cars with Rick Ocasek and Ben Orr and all these people. You know, and that was so spot on accurate, right? That in fact, if you had that vehicle in 1979, you're gonna have a Cars.
I'm pretty impressed by this. This is good deep knowledge here.
This is real. So yeah, we're not fooling around anymore.
And have we agreed that the Cars debut album was the best debut album top to bottom?
I think pretty close.
Oh, who's that? Somebody knows.
Yeah. And but you also held out the band Boston as pretty
I did.
Very
that was a good
as well.
One. Yeah.
So anyway, this is the thing. When you're driving around in 1979 listening to the Cars and Candio or whatever's playing, you're probably not thinking you're going to be spending a lot of time with rock stars. But when you get to be the nominee for Vice President of the United States, you actually get to hang out with rock stars. So
it's a perk. That is a perk.
It is, because you're into me. You are into it.
You
right?
are.
And so what I want to know is your best rock star story from the 2024 campaign.
Yes. Two. One is the campaign tells me, and it's young campaign staffers, so they I don't blame them. They just didn't know. But they said, Governor, you've been using this John Mellencamp music, you know, as your walkout song, but we got a call and we had a request at the convention if after you get your nomination, if we could play, this artist asked if you could play his music. And I said, really? Yeah. And this young staffer said, yeah, this guy named Neil Young wants you to play Rockin' in the Free World. And I'm like, what'd you say? He said, Neil Young wants you to play Rockin' in the Free World and you get nominated. And I just turned to my wife. I said, I can die now. I am perfectly dead. But
it's done. But I have achieved it.
The one where I got to, and I didn't get to meet Neil in that case, but we're doing an event down in, I think, Atlanta or Savannah, and it was in the hold room. I spent a lot of time back by dumpsters, and they issue in, and the Secret Service, I couldn't see anybody and all this, whatever. But we're going down a hallway, and I look down the hall, and the door was kind of open, and they're playing music in there. And I look down there, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going there. And the Secret Service says, no, I said, I'm going to go down there. And I walk to the door, and the individual who was there singing waves me in. And it was Michael Stipe from REM playing with John Bon Jovi and Parliament. And they were practicing what they were going to sing. And I sat there and watched them, that these musicians, as they were doing that. And those of you, again, of a certain age, REM was college music beyond anything we could ever imagine. And there was Michael Stipe, and I fanboyed the crap out of it. I'm like, oh my God. It was a little embarrassing, but I said, and he said, well, what song do you want to hear? I said, well, I'd like to hear Driver 8. He said, I haven't played Driver 8 in decades. And I said, well, Ken, he went out and sang Driver 8 with John Bon Jovi and Parliament. And so that's my, really cool, really cool.
You get to hang out with the Parliament Funkadelic thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that's it.
That's it. That's a pretty
good
one.
And now I just name drop. Oh, yeah, when I was hanging out with Michael Stipe, this is what we did. I hope he remembers me. So
we've talked about a lot of stuff tonight, and you've been very generous with your comments on it. As we said earlier, this has been a pretty tough week. But backstage, we were talking about it, and you were asking me about the people who had appeared this week.
Yeah.
And you said, was this person optimistic? Did they, you know, and I said, well, a little bit down there, and the other person a little bit up, and stuff like that. And it is a time where a lot of people are really wrestling. And as we circle around to the end here, let me ask you, at the end of the day, do we make it through?
Yeah.
Do we get to the other side? Are you optimistic about where this country is going?
Yes. Supervised the lunchroom for 20 years. I'm an optimist. And so, no, I am. And I think you need to gather in spaces like this. Look, it's very hard emotionally. I went last weekend from that little boy's funeral to a wedding, and I think this idea of, in this moment, where do we find our joy? Where do we find our purpose? And I'll close us out with another of those great rock poets or whatever. Bruce Springsteen was right. It ain't no sin to be glad you're alive. And we're alive. We got a chance to change this. We have a chance to make a difference. And I think in the midst of this heartache and turmoil, we can do it. There's always reasons to show gratitude. Every morning I wake up, I express great gratitude that I'm not a Republican, for starters. And then, so there you go. So.
Ladies and gentlemen, the governor of Minnesota, my vice president at the moment, Tim Walz.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Civic Media's coverage of Cap Times 2025 Idea Fest. Thank you to Luke Mathers, Dominic Lee, Parker Olson, Dan Schaefer, and Todd Albaugh for making this broadcast possible. I'm Aaron Zommers, and we now return you to your regularly scheduled Civic Media programming.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Superman and Lex Luthor teaming up together? What is this world coming to? Before you know it, cats and dogs will be living together. Variety has announced that the sequel for this summer's hit Superman is in motion. If you thought the first one was a spectacle, the follow-up promises an even bigger nemesis will face off against the unlikely duo. James Gunn's Superman, starring David Corenswet, made $613 million worldwide and was a big first swing for the DC Universe, a company where Gunn currently serves as co-CEO. James Gunn says the sequel will be as much a Lex Luthor film as it will be a Superman film. The director says he loved working with Nicholas Holt, who played Luthor, and really identified with the Luthor character. Yikes. A couple other tidbits from Gunn's Superman world. The director says Supergirl, starring Millie Alcock, is on the schedule to be released in 2026. Superman, A Man of Tomorrow, will start filming in 2026 and be released in 2027. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Mr. Pat Kreitlow joins us from Lake Wissota.
Everything that I know about high culture, everything I know about opera, for example, comes from Bugs Bunny cartoon. The kids are missing out these days. They got Bluey and all of that.
Well, now it's all like real.
We had coyotes falling off of cliffs. Come on.
Exactly. And now it's all this educational crap.
We really have just become the two old men rocking on the porch talking about days gone by.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
Ahoo, this is Robert Pilot of Nativerts Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
At WFHR, Laura Berg, who is voice talent producer.
The thing about Central Wisconsin is what really matters is that your neighbors are okay and you're okay, no matter what your neighbor is. And if you reach out that hand and get to know them, the whole town's going to be better for it.
You got to take time to listen to people that might be a little different than you, but you can find commonalities if we just listen to one another.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Why is cookie dough in everything now? It was fun when you were a kid and actually ate the cookie dough. But in ice cream, it's just a weird, it's like an interruption for the gorgeous texture that is cold cream ice cream. And then, oh, and here's this uncooked egg and whatever it is. There's a fudge ribbon swirl. Awesome. Vanilla ice cream. Great. Peanut butter cups. Great. Nuts. Awesome. Cookie dough. Barf.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Good day to be indigenous. Get up, stand up.
They are going to become more brutal.
Couldn't cut. He didn't cut it, even.
Because all the hippies were trying to be Indians anyway.
I'm Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, and I want to be your next United States Senator, and you are listening to Native Roots Radio.
Welcome back to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm Awake, and this is Robert Pilot. Hey, welcome back, everybody. We are here with our friend Rachel Dion Thunder with Indigenous Protectors Movement, one of the co-founders. And it says that you are the vice president. I really think you're the president, so I'm just going to introduce you that way.
Crow's the president. Crowbell is the president.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah.
Oh. I thought your husband was, so I thought
No. My husband's on the board. So no, Crow's the president and I'm the vice president. And then Issa is actually our cultural arts and organizer for IPM.
Well, we have a compelling story that you're telling, and I was watching it over Facebook and I was amazed, one, that a lot of people were able to be there. It was, if I remember, it was raining. It was early in the morning or late morning. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what the heck is going on here? And so my Facebook feeds were blowing up. And it's great to hear, really, with you boots on the ground, what happened and what's happening right now. So welcome back. And keep on telling this really intense story.
For sure. So pretty quickly, word spread through community that ICE was here. It was like, that was the message kind of being shared around. And so a lot of people went there really to just to document and to see for themselves. And if you were there, you saw like ICE was here. You know, and they left, and then there was like kind of like a small protest that happened there afterwards. I actually left because I had gotten mace like in my eyes and breathed it in, so I left to go home to take a shower and change. But you know what, really after that day, you know, because it instilled so much fear in community, it instilled fear into like obviously the immigrant community, but also just, you know, we were thinking it's just like, you know, when are they coming back, that this was just like the first test that they're going to be back, because we're seeing like what's happening in LA, we're seeing like now what's happening in DC, and so like that is kind of more what the fear was. There was never a fear that one of us was going to be in trouble for what happened that day, because it didn't even cross our minds that anybody had done anything wrong. You know, we had just been there to record and be present and kind of be witness to see like the, because you know they were really being rough. Those federal officers were being really rough with a lot of community members.
Right.
And so you know, about a week, you know, a week or so passed, and we were kind of like strategically planning, you know, an art build and, you know, trying to build a narrative in the media around that ICE is not welcome in Minneapolis and really reinforcing that through city council and looking specifically like, you know, at the, you know, how Minneapolis had made the statement or said that, you know, that MPD was not going to be cooperating with ICE, that that needs to now include task force because we found this loophole where they can come into community.
Yeah.
And so we were honestly kind of blindsided. Issa Vela Lopez, who's one of our employees at IPM, she's a community member. She is an artist. She's a poet. She does a lot of spoken word poetry. She's gotten to travel all around the world with that. I think she's formed in Dubai. She, wow. I know this year she just traveled to New York City and read a poem at the National Writers Guild Gala in New York City. So, you know, she's very loved, and she was actually going to do an interview in downtown St. Paul. We were at work and she was like, I'm going to go do this interview. And she's like, what do you think? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I think you should do it. Just be careful. You know, and so she left. And then the next thing I knew, I was getting phone calls that these people in these vans had taken Issa. Wow. And I was like, she was just here. And so, at first, like my first thought was like, actually ICE, like that ICE had taken her. And then, you know, we were able to like track her phone, like through her, like the at share, like sharing location. And, she was taken to Sherbourne. And so we know that federal cases go to Sherbourne.
And how far is that from St. Paul?
It's just like, it's north. It's like outside the cities, like in the suburbs. So maybe an hour. And so we, when that was like our first hint at like what was happening. And as like the next hours unfolded, we found out that the feds were charging her with multiple felonies regarding that day that ICE came to Minneapolis on June 3rd. And so that kind of really, that brings us to present day. She was held, I believe, for 4 days. And then she was released at her first hearing. After her first hearing, she pled not guilty to all of her federal charges. We were able to secure her a really good lawyer, Jordan Kushner. He's represented folks up at Line 3. He represented Mike Forsha when everything was going on with city council. And I think that he's just a really good brain and a really good lawyer. And I think that he understands the political climate that we're in and how to navigate it. And so, you know, collaborating with him, and really there's this ugly narrative, and this is what happens every time, right, Robert? Like over the years, this is just what they do, is that they don't tell the story of us as people, as community members. They spin this negative light on us, that we're not just protesters, that were like these radical activists or even terrorists. You know, a lot of AIM members have been called terrorists in the past, and they're trying to paint Issa as like this hardened like criminal that was interfering with the federal government. And you know, if you know Issa, you just know that that is not true. You know, she's literally like, she's like 5'3", like 100 pounds soaking wet. Like, I don't think that she was going to stop, like physically stop anybody that day, you know,
I was gonna say that. in talking to her and knowing a little bit of her, she's too smart to fall into that. She's a very smart person, as you mentioned, you know, her poetry and an artist and things like that. So what are they saying that she did? And I mean, that's the bizarre thing.
Yeah. So there's I believe there's four charges, two assault, one interference. Yeah. And so recently they offered her a plea deal. And so today, just to bring it full circle here. Today we held a press conference in front of the federal courthouse, downtown Minneapolis. Issa was there. I was there. I spoke. Issa's lawyer spoke, Jordan. Members from MIRAC, the Minnesota Immigrants Rights Action Committee, spoke. Yeah, and Homegirls for Issa, which is kind of like this group supporters for Issa, was there organizing. So we were supporting them really as IPM today. But the main point of the press conference today was that she was offered a plea deal. And the plea deal that they offered her is to plead guilty to the interference charge and that they would drop all the other charges and serve 8 to 14 months.
What?
And if she does not take the plea, then they are going to follow with going ahead with all of the charges for max sentencing of 57 months for a nonviolent being present at a protest.
There's
community
video.
Is being attacked.
There's video of her, right? There's information out there. They can't get away with this.
Exactly. And so today at the press conference, the whole point was that officially announce that she is not taking the plea deal, that she is taking this to trial, and that really, in reality, if anything, if they're going to charge her with anything, give her a misdemeanor. Nobody got hurt. Mm-hmm. No one was injured. You know, no federal agent was injured that day. And that really, really what they're trying to do here is intimidate not only her, but the entire movement. The entire movement that is building, you know, in opposition to this current administration.
Right.
To federal raids by ICE. By families being broken up by this administration's policies, to the atmosphere of violence that this administration seeds into communities. You know, there's very violent things happening nearly every day. And I firmly believe that a lot of that is because of this atmosphere that this administration creates.
Absolutely.
And so that's the message that they're trying to send. They're trying, because that's what they do, right? That's what this administration's tactics are. They use intimidation, they use fear, they use control to try and scare people, communities, and movements into not resisting, to not opposing, to not standing up against these atrocities. And they're trying to make an example out of Issa. She's the only one out of anybody that was charged that day.
Unbelievable. Hey, we are here with Rachel Dion Thunder, Vice President of an Indigenous Protectors Movement, and we're talking about our relative here and what's happened. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that and maybe even what the solution is. And I always like what we can do action-wise here to our listeners. So, hey, we'll be right back. This is Native Roots Radio.
You're listening to WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee, WMDX Columbus, Madison, WCFW HD2 W228 EP Chippewa Falls, WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, WLAK Amory, and WLCX La Crosse, a part of the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. John Roberts, Supreme Court, crazy decision. Welcome to one of those dystopian nightmare novels that were meant as cautionary tales, not as how-to manuals, that no working class American has ever or would ever volunteer to sign up for, no matter how loudly some are cheerleading on the right. This is the kind of authoritarian nightmare that we learned about as kids in high school. You know, those books that they're now trying to ban. And understand, picture it in the very near future, where every time you step outside, there could be a policeman, an ICE officer, or whomever Trump decides, or any future leader decides, you need to be looked into. A neighbor didn't quite think enough of you, and now you're gonna have to prove your citizenship. You're gonna have to have your car searched, because evidently this is where we're going. Have your phone searched, all your digital records, because we're doing everything digitally. Or